Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. A lot of thought and energy is being invested in coming up with a plan B for local economies in eastern Kentucky coal country. Nothing clear-cut at this point. Some look to outside investment and industrial recruitment. Others say that's been tried, and we see how that turned out. It's time to reinvent the regional economy from the ground up. Some very smart people are putting their minds to this task. Believing that it's encouraging to hear of these ideas, we want to bring them to your attention as we learn of them. And in this hour, you'll hear from several. Allison Davis is Executive Director of the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky. Dr. Davis is a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Kentucky, and she's co-editor of Choices, the online magazine about food, farms, and resource use. And she's here to help us wrap our minds around a strategy in the works, something from MIT called REAP. That stands for Regional Entrepreneurship Acceleration Program. It's global in scope, but Kentucky is the only region in the United States currently participating. Thanks for joining us, Allison.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So first, if you would give us the basics of this MIT initiative, why was it created? What's its goal?
So the MIT REAP program is designed to bring multiple partners crossing both the private and public sector together to support creating an entrepreneurial ecosystem all across the world.
We're in a period of major transition in the state, so it would seem that Kentucky would be ripe for this. But is there a particular reason that Kentucky was selected to participate?
Well, Kentucky is very ripe for this. I think it's the right time because we had a transition in leadership and some resources at the state level that were dedicated to creating a more entrepreneurial ecosystem through the Cabinet for Economic Development. And in addition, we have SOAR, who's a partner, who also considers entrepreneurship a critical path moving forward in the Appalachian region.
The Kentucky page on the REAP website says REAP Team Kentucky is, quote, building a culture that inspires, supports, and sustains entrepreneurship through utilizing Kentucky's diverse resources. Does that culture exist, and is it as robust as it needs to be?
The culture exists, but it's not as robust as it needs to be. We have found through some of the data that MIT has provided to us that some of our surrounding states appear to have a higher quality of entrepreneurs across a broader part of their state. And so I think we have the ground for it, the foundation, but I don't think it's uniform across the entire state. And I think there's room for improvement all across even our city areas.
What has to happen to improve the quality of our entrepreneurs?
There are several facets. It's not as easy as just starting a new business. And so it's really aligning, creating infrastructure for individuals who have good ideas, getting them through an accelerator type of process, trying to link them up with the right type of capital, whether it be risk capital or traditional capital, and really helping them grow once they get past that first stage.
The application to take part in REAP calls for a shared vision for our regional innovation ecosystem. What is the vision for Kentucky?
Well, the vision is that we are a state of makers. I also say we're a state of takers because of our strong logistics support structure. So we believe that we're going to capitalize on what Kentucky is really unique about. So whether it's bourbon, the horse farms, our natural resources, and, you know, frankly, our manufacturing, which has done very well, we plan to capitalize on what we are currently doing well.
So as I understand it, you are in the midst of this two-year engagement, and each team is to implement at least one strategic intervention that will help improve a particular weakness in their region's innovation ecosystem. So what particular Kentucky weakness has been singled out for attention?
Well, we have several, and I think we have to address them all together because to just address one would just leave us short of where we want to be. But we believe that we do not have enough investable, innovation-driven businesses already. We do not have the right matching of capital to the needs of our businesses. And frankly, we don't have communities that are entrepreneur-centric. We still focus a lot of our energies on recruiting firms in, as opposed to thinking about creating a community that supports entrepreneurship and has all of the necessary services to make them successful.
Going to the investment part of this, entrepreneurship almost always entails greater than normal financial risk. But is the capital available to launch a successful startup in Appalachian, Kentucky?
That's a tricky question because it depends. It depends on where that business is, the type of business, the potential risk associated with that business. So we have, as part of our REAP team, we have the largest venture capitalist as part of our team, Brad Zapp. And so he'll say there is capital, but then he'll say we don't have the right mix of firms that we are willing to invest in. And so I think it's having all types of capital available, some that are traditional, some that are a bit more risk averse, some that are a bit more risky, to sort of satisfy the needs of all of our different types of potential new businesses.
MIT is all about education for practical application. In this case, taking theory from classroom and applying it to local innovation-driven entrepreneurial ecosystems. It's a mouthful. What is an innovation-driven entrepreneurial ecosystem?
Well, there's been discussion in the past and the research about, are you born an entrepreneur? Are you made an entrepreneur? And what that means is it's trying to delineate if we are entrepreneurs because we have to or because we are born with that risk-loving nature and sort of this very strong innovation type of mentality, which is innately risky. And so we have found that areas that prosper through entrepreneurship are really those businesses that are more risky in nature, more creative, more innovative, and not necessarily those that were born out of necessity. And so Kentucky hasn't really been much of an innovation-driven economy. We haven't been as successful in recruiting individuals who are going to create those types of economies, but we have hope that we can still achieve that in the future.
You know, I always think of entrepreneurs as those people who identify a void in the market somehow and step in there and supply whatever it's needed to meet that unidentified demand. And then you snap your fingers and think, why didn't I think of that?
Right.
So does entrepreneurialism have to be in your DNA? Is it a learned thing?
The research is mixed, and some research will say, yes, you are born an entrepreneur, but you can still be born without that DNA and be able to assess a situation, have really good business partners who might be able to pull you through your weaknesses. But I think the real critical piece of an entrepreneur is exactly as you said, identifying a problem that may or may not have even surfaced and creating a solution to it. Because that's how entrepreneurial businesses grow, is because what they have created is suddenly identified as a tremendous need and there's a market ready to purchase.
As I mentioned before, you're halfway through the 2-year period. Are you at this point able to see the outcome of this and imagine some takeaways that might actually apply to Kentucky?
I think so. You know, we are fortunate in that the Cabinet for Economic Development has, alongside of what we're doing, and they're a partner with this initiative, but they have invested significant resources and people into creating an entrepreneurial ecosystem. And it's really important to have a partner, particularly at the state, that's willing to go and kind of lead this effort. And so I think we have a series of what MIT calls must-win battles that we believe we'll be able to implement within the next year that we think will have really trackable outcomes that would indicate that we are moving towards a more entrepreneurial ecosystem.
In your view, Allison, is Eastern Kentucky in particular, I know we're talking about the whole state, but our focus is pretty much on Appalachian Kentucky. Is the region fertile ground for entrepreneurialism, do you think?
It is fertile ground. I believe that we need to overcome some significant obstacles to make Appalachia, Kentucky sort of the next entrepreneurial community, whether it's ensuring that our communities support risky behavior, you know, risk-taking and creating new businesses, whether it's creating networks of other entrepreneurs who can support someone who's never tried this before, whether it's ensuring that the business has access to an accelerator, whether it's a business has access to the right type of capital. We tend to know that in rural places, this certainly does not fare as well as in urban places. But I can assure you, as we're going through this process, we are thinking of the entire state of Kentucky, recognizing that a lot of our activity doesn't, of course, happen in the Triangle, but knowing that the future of Appalachia really relies on this entrepreneurial spirit, whether it's social or whether it's business, for it to be successful past the coal era.
Well, as we said in the beginning, we're going through a transition, and of course, a transition takes us somewhere. So it's really good to know that there's a group of people that are actually actively thinking this through.
Absolutely.
Allison Davis is Executive Director of the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky and a Professor of Agricultural Economics at the University of Kentucky. Thanks, Dr. Davis.
Thank you for having me.
Allison Davis mentioned that people in Kentucky state government have been working to create an entrepreneurial ecosystem. Well, after the break, we'll hear from one of them, the head of innovation and entrepreneurship in the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development, Brian Mefford. His mission? Taking concepts from workbench to market.
That's what really commercialization means. It's taking an idea and turning it into a business, a product, or a service that someone somewhere will pay for.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
What's needed to create an environment where people are encouraged to make something of their ideas, to become innovators and entrepreneurs, and take the results to the marketplace? Brian Mefford seemed like the right person to ask. He is, after all, head of innovation and entrepreneurship in the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development. And Brian joins us to tell us something about the Commonwealth Commercialization Center, or C3. Greetings, Brian.
Hello, Tom. It's great to be with you.
We appreciate you joining us. And right out of the gate, first question, what does C3 do?
C3 is a new entity that we've created. It's a partnership between the State Economic Development Cabinet and all of our state universities to support and provide fuel for entrepreneurship and innovation in Kentucky. So it's a newly created science and technology nonprofit. And like I said, it's an engine for statewide innovation geared towards fueling economic growth, creating life-changing impact for individuals. And that's more why we exist. What we do is work with entrepreneurs, innovators, whether they be on our university campuses or coming up out of our communities. We provide them sort of a pathway to success by connecting them with resources that they need, with funding that they need, and just surrounding them with community across Kentucky to connect them to, you know, whether it be to the right customer base, the right resources, the right mentors to really fuel the growth of their their ideas and their companies.
Okay. I don't want to go too far down into the organization weeds, but something really stands out here that I think is interesting. I want to ask you about. C3 is a nonprofit within state government, and its budget is approved by the state legislature. That seems unusual, is it?
Well, actually, it was kind of created out of a mandate from the legislature. So you go back, 20 years in history, and the legislature said, we really want to invest in innovation in Kentucky, and we want to model our approach. We want to be innovative in how we do this. So the legislature actually directed the Economic Development Cabinet to work with nonprofits in the science and technology space. And so they really wanted to create sort of flexibility in how, economic development how the cabinet itself could employ strategies with the private sector. And so that's really the basis of why we work with and through a nonprofit.
And I know the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation was set up in response to the 2001 Kentucky Innovation Act to oversee such things as commercializing university research, providing state matching funds for federal small business research grants. How does C3 differ from what KSTC does?
C3 is set up in partnership with the university. So the idea here with C3 is that we really wanted to put university-based innovation in the driver's seat for this part of our economic development strategy. And so UK and U of L, for instance, came together and said, look, we have developed resources over the years, and we have people who support innovation on our campuses, meaning things like intellectual property attorneys and resources that help get an idea out of the lab, set up as a business, and then support for growing that business. Those are resources that not all of our universities have, just due to things like budget constraints and just mission oriented towards teaching more than research. But that doesn't mean that they don't have good ideas coming out of the universities, whether it's their scientists or their students, their staff. And so UK and U of L came together and they said, we can pool these resources. And if the state invests more in these resources, we can then make them available to all of our universities. And so that's really the thrust of what we're doing with C3 that's different than what's been done in the past.
So are you developing a new strategy to give lift to the innovation, even the entrepreneurialism that is percolating on our university campuses?
That's exactly right. And there's so much good work that's happening on our university campuses. And again, whether that's happening in science labs or it's students that have an idea sparked in an economics class or even in a music class, something that they may be working on that solves a problem or addresses a need in a novel way, and they haven't necessarily thought about how could they turn that into a business or how could they turn that into a service. That's what really commercialization means. It's taking an idea and turning it into a business, a product, or a service that someone somewhere will pay for. And so that's exactly right. I mean, we're providing the support, the mechanisms to take those ideas, whether it's a novel idea or something that can be patented, something that can be licensed, turning that into a product and a service that then creates jobs for our communities.
State government is not known for being all that nimble or flexible, and I'm wondering how can government accommodate all the uncertainties and the trial and error that are common to the entrepreneurial experience?
Yeah, that's such a great question, and that's part of the challenge and why I think the legislature had such good foresight to say, let's make sure that this is done in a private-public partnership way, and really why we've set up C3 the way we have. And really, we've looked at it, we've modeled best practices from around the country. And the truth is, while the legislature stepped out 20 years ago to set the course for innovation strategy and programming in the state, in many cases, sort of the inertia of government took over, and we've really needed to update these strategies and these programs. So that's part of what C3 is driving towards. And again, we've taken modeling from best practices and peers around the peer states, other states around the country. And we've got some catch up to do, but this work with C3 and through C3 and our universities is helping to move us forward.
I'm wondering how you're addressing the matter of intellectual property. You know, when students or faculty or staff develop a concept, let's say on a university's clock, on the university property, do their ideas then become the intellectual property of the institution, or can they be separated out?
You know, each university tends to have their own intellectual property policy. And that's something that that C3 is actually working or will be working with each university to help, you know, take a look at those policies and see how they might be adapted to be more sort of clear and user-friendly and geared towards making it simpler to start a business with an idea and making it more attractive. Of course, that's one of the many reasons that, you know, people may decide not to become an entrepreneur, not to take that idea and turn it into a business, because it is difficult. And so if we can work with our universities to help remove some of the friction and some of the difficulty, then that's going to make it more attractive for somebody to step out of the lab and start a business.
Well, tell us about your accelerator program. Why an initial focus on agricultural technology?
Well, yeah, we're excited about this work that's come out of the partnership that we have with MIT. And it's a unique partnership that we've been fortunate to have as we reset the innovation strategy for the state. And we have a nice cross-section of folks who are involved in that work at MIT. And one of the things that have come out of that is this need to create a statewide network of accelerators. And again, then we say, okay, that makes sense. So where do we begin? Well, we begin with some of our strengths. And across the state, we have such strong attributes in agriculture. And we have a lot of agriculture technology work that's already in process. So part of this is just organizing that and making more resources available to those companies that are taking advantage of agriculture innovation and connecting them and creating culture around agriculture innovation. And so that's why we start with AgTech.
The late Dr. Pierce Lyons, the founder of AllTech, had a vision of establishing Lexington as something of an ag tech hub, and Mayor Linda Gordon has expressed interest in exploring that idea. Is C3 tapping into that?
Without a doubt. And Dr. Lyons, you know, we miss him dearly, and his son Mark and his wife Deirdre have certainly continued to advance that vision for making this region sort of the center of the universe for ag tech. And absolutely, you have others joining that vision, like you mentioned, not just Mayor Gordon, but also Ryan Quarles and Governor Bevin all share this vision. And so it's not a pipe dream. I mean, this is something that really, with concerted effort and investment, I mean, it does take an investment of time and energy and money, but we really can make that happen. We can realize that vision that Dr. Lyons laid out so many years ago.
I have a question here it's a little uncomfortable for all of us, I think, but I just wonder what you think of it. And you're one who's working to encourage and to develop entrepreneurial activity in Kentucky. Does it concern you that Kentucky is one of only five states in the country that has been cutting its funding of higher education? Doesn't that work at cross purposes against what you're trying to accomplish and against economic development?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, we have constrained resources almost at every turn. So, you know, I'm just focused on making the most of what we have. I'm no expert in the funding strategy or the new funding methodology for our universities. But what I understand and what I hear from our university leaders is it causes them to focus on their biggest strengths. And so what we can do as C3 is then come in and say, well, we can help you in areas that you may not be able to invest in otherwise. And so with funding constraints, we're going to provide resources to your faculty, to your staff, to support them in cultivating their ideas and support you as a university. If you have sort of ideas or patents or innovations that are sort of on the shelf, so to speak, we can now provide you resources to help turn those things into businesses and you know, potentially provide revenue streams back to the universities.
Well, Brian, you're clearly immersed in this. I'm just wondering, what is your assessment as one who moves about the state discussing entrepreneurialism, innovation? What's your assessment of Kentucky's potential to move in a big and a meaningful way towards a more entrepreneurial culture and economy?
Tom, I am so optimistic. Being on the road every day across the state, I mean, every corner of our state, every community, there are exciting things happening, and that's not an overstatement. People have really tuned in to the notion that practically all of our net new job creation comes from startups, and so people realize that they have to be engaged somehow in the startup community and in this culture of turning ideas into businesses if they're going to see their communities thrive over time. And so our rural areas, this is a place where folks have committed to not being left behind. And the fact that you can start a business and grow a business in today's economy from anywhere in the world, we look at the strengths that we have as Kentucky, and we are a state of makers and dreamers and artists, and we know that it's a recipe for success, and we know that we can make it happen here in Kentucky. And that spirit is just pervasive everywhere I go across the state.
Brian Mefford heads innovation and entrepreneurship in the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development. We thank you so much, Brian.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Are we missing something important when we try to measure rural versus urban innovation? Dr. Brian Whitaker with the Oklahoma State University Department of Agricultural Economics has researched that question and joins us from Stillwater, Oklahoma, to talk about what he's learned. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate you having me on.
You bet. And so as I understand it, you found that the standard way of measuring innovation may miss the homegrown ways that rural firms introduce new ideas for operating their businesses. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, I think that's right. So, you know, some colleagues and I were essentially dissatisfied with the way that innovation has typically been measured. And so we used a survey that was specifically designed to capture some alternative ways of measuring innovation, and found that this new measure really was linked to things like better wages paid, market growth, and even median household income growth in those areas. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about the idea of innovation.
Has there been a one-size-fits-all approach to sizing up urban and rural innovation, both of them, when in fact there are important differences?
Yeah, I think you're right on target there. So the traditional approach to saying what's innovative and what's not has really been focused on things that are easy to measure. So we do things like we count the number of patents that come from a certain area, or we think about the amount of dollars that are invested by companies in research and development. But the truth is that does not capture a lot of what rural America does. So obviously those measures I just mentioned are going to be skewed towards urban. But if you think about what rural America does, it's not necessarily pouring money into research and development or, you know, having a ton and ton of patents. It's more things like responding to what their customers want. And so we try to conduct our research more along those frames and capture a broader measure of innovation.
I think, and I wonder if you agree here, that we all kind of run this risk of viewing rural America through that one-size-fits-all lens, when in reality there are cultural, socioeconomic, and geographic differences that vary from region to region. Is that accurate?
I completely agree. You know, I'm a rural development economist, and we always see, you know, a tremendous amount of variation across rural America. And we saw it in this study. We saw a lot of variation in what rural companies are doing across the board. And, you know, certainly from his experience, we know there's important differences in how rural counties have responded to things like the Great Recession. You know, some are doing quite well. Some have not even recovered from that. So there's absolutely a lot of variation that needs to be accounted for.
So tell us about this broader innovation index that you and your colleagues have developed.
Okay, so the cool thing about this study is that the ERS, Economic Research Service, realized this was an issue, and I want to thank Tim Wojan at ERS for realizing this. And so they conducted a pretty thorough survey of over 50,000 businesses, and they really geared it towards non-metropolitan or rural places. And they asked what we thought were 15 specific questions that were somehow related to innovation. And so in our paper, we lay those 15 different questions out, and we kind of group them into four categories. And so the categories are innovative accomplishments. So it's things like, what percentage of your sales are through new or improved goods? Do you sell new goods before the competition? And then we have a second grouping called intellectual property. So that is things like patents. We wanted to account for that, but it's also things like trademarks, copyrights, non-disclosures. And then our third factor is called innovation sources. So that's sources of how companies get new information. And then our fourth is what we call customer focus. So how often they monitor customer satisfaction, and then really the impact of things like customer complaints on their business practices. So we kind of grouped these four different factors and created a 0 to 1 measure, where 0 is not very innovative and 1 is very, very innovative. And we had this, so it's a kind of a continuous measure here of an innovation index, where we can kind of classify businesses on how we think they fare.
So can you give us some examples of how rural firms are actually being innovative in ways that might not have been detected before you developed this tool?
So, yeah, I want to point out the survey did not explicitly capture actual examples from firms. Mm-hmm. So it didn't have any open-ended questions. But if you look at the questions that they do ask, you can kind of infer some things that might happen. So, for example, you know, a highly innovative firm would have, you know, a lot of different sources of how they get their information. They would regularly monitor customer satisfaction and use that information. And they would sell new goods and services early, and they would regularly offer new goods and services. So, you know, drawing on kind of my own history, I used to work in a rural steel mill back in my high school and you know, during my college days. And I think of some of the manufacturing that went on in that steel mill. And, you know, what they did that I thought was innovative is they listened to their customer feedback. If someone came in and say, hey, you know, this thing worked okay, but I think it would be, I really needed to do this instead, they could just offer a slight tweak on the way they made their product. And that, to me, is innovation. It's not going to be captured in a patent. It's not going to be captured in research and development dollars, but it's responding to a customer's request and you know, coming up with a new product. You know, another example I kind of came up with is, say you're in a service-oriented business, and maybe, you know, incorporating an online platform that allows for easier scheduling. That's innovative. And that's something that, again, is going to not be captured in the traditional measures. So those are just a couple of examples that I think may have been underlying the data.
It sounds to me that being innovative requires a tolerance for flexibility, for agility, to be able to respond to those customer ideas and suggestions.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, one of the biggest factors that we saw was this whole idea of, you know, do you monitor customer satisfaction and what is the impact of that? And so I think, you know, being flexible, understanding that it's not just a rigid process, we're not going to, you know, take anyone's input into account other than ours. You need to listen to, you know, not just your customers, but also others in the industry and kind of stay on top of things. I think that's crucial. I think you're right about that.
So I think I understand that your findings are suggesting that federal, state, and local initiatives supporting innovation should not focus only on research and development, R&D, or on patent-oriented metrics. What else should be taken into consideration?
Well, I think, you know, looking at the basic finding of the study is that we think more broader measures should be taken into account. So, you know, if you look at formal U.S. innovation policy, the things like the small business innovation research, they typically emphasize things like technology development, and that's kind of, you know, typical customary types of what we think of as innovation. So if we define innovation more broadly, you know, things that are typical of more small businesses, as we've shown, that can potentially have positive impacts for firms and for the local regions. So if you think about, you know, the specific factors that we mentioned, you know, if we can somehow find ways to incentivize firms to develop new sources of information or assess and use customer satisfaction, you know, that I think would be awesome if we could come up with some kind of a federal or state policy to emphasize those, you know, non-traditional measures. I think that would be very beneficial.
Does this new measurement tool that you have developed, does it make it possible to identify connections between innovation in rural America and higher pay and growth in markets?
Yeah, that's actually one thing our paper really set out to do is once we derived this factor, we said, okay, can we say that this innovation index has impacts on things like pay, you know, local income? And if you look through the paper, we absolutely did find that. We found that it was positively related to things like wages paid by the company and the market growth of that company. And we found it was positively related to things like median household income, the percentage of creative class employees in an area. So it generally had very, very positive impacts, not just for the business, but for the local surrounding economy.
So, Brian, how should we be thinking differently about the business growth potential of rural America?
Well, you know, we tend to get caught up in things like unemployment rates and median household income and you know, wages paid. But if we can think of a way to quantify innovation in a different way, and we've attempted to do that in this paper, I think we can kind of move beyond those traditional metrics and think about how innovation can help improve some of them for the local business as well as the broader economy.
Your study was completed a few years ago. Do you hope to update it?
We'd love to. The problem is this Rees survey was a kind of a one-of-a-kind thing. Now, ERS is trying to get some more funding to do follow-on surveys, but it was a pretty big survey. Like I said, 50,000 businesses. So, and as always, the federal money for surveys is a little tight. So I haven't heard anything about that in a while. We would love to do it if they continue with this line of survey.
Okay. And what you're referring to there is the Rural Establishment Innovation Survey, for the acronym Rees. And we'll post a link to that on our website on esweku.com under the Facts and Information tab. Dr. Brian Whitaker with the Oklahoma State University Department of Agricultural Economics, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break, for-profit businesses with social or environmental missions. A look at the B Corp.
Companies that are measuring, reporting on a social or environmental good that they're doing. B Corps also have a set of values.
What are they? We'll have the answer in just a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
From his office in Louisville, we're joined by Scott Collins. He's the founder of Canopy, a startup nonprofit working to support and recognize for-profit businesses that have a stated social or environmental mission. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you advocate for a socially conscious and impact-driven business movement in Kentucky. Tell us what that means.
It means businesses that are defining the way they see success. We're measuring not only profitability, but also measuring the good that we're doing in our neighborhoods and in our communities, and also internally, the good we're doing by treating people well.
And how do you go about measuring those things?
Well, I mean, internally with culture, oftentimes it shows up in metrics like retention and turnover. And are your people sticking around? Are they sharing how great it is to work at your workplace with other people? Are you getting a lot of employee referrals? So, you know, that shows up in a lot of different ways. Externally, you know, you're looking at how many people are you helping out there? What kind of time are you putting into helping the community? And, you know, we're not really getting into necessarily outcomes. We leave that maybe with our community partners and others we work with, but we're thinking more about how are we putting our time and resources and measuring that as we go about doing our business.
I'm curious about the name of your organization, Canopy. How did you come to name it Canopy?
Well, we utilize the services of a wonderful creative company that does branding out of Lexington, Kentucky, named Bullhorn, mm-hmm. who happens to be one of the 7 B corporations in the state of Kentucky. And they arrived at the name, and it's a metaphorical name that really is trying to express this idea of a strong network of for-profit businesses, a canopy, if you will, covering the state, working together to help with our social and economic problems.
I know that you, Scott, played an important role in the passage of public benefit corporation or B Corp legislation in Kentucky in 2017. What characteristics distinguish a B Corp from other companies?
Right. There's certainly a set of values that go with that. So, yeah, I helped get the public benefit corporation legislation passed with State Rep Miller. And really what that's driving it is companies that are measuring, reporting on a social or environmental good that they're doing. B Corps also have a set of values that they operate with. A few of them, for example, are transparency. That we as organizations are trying to move towards being open about maybe problems that occur within the organization, being more open about our financial dealings. And, you know, this is a spectrum. You know, it's important to articulate that we're talking about getting businesses on a path towards these values showing up in the work that they're doing. It's not a you are transparent or you aren't. It's more about the idea of you're making a commitment to become more transparent. And openness, transparency, equity, appreciation of diversity within the organization, the idea of being intentional about selecting your vendors, appreciating local vendors, appreciating vendors that are coming from different backgrounds. These are some of the values that you'll see show up in B Corps.
I heard something there very interesting. I've worked for, I dare say, almost everybody has or is working for a business, a company that holds its financial dealings very close to the vest. And did I hear you say that you are more transparent about those?
Right. So FMS, the company, the for-profit company that I own.
And that's Facilities Management Services, correct?
That is correct. Yes, we're a B Corp and we're also a PBC. So one of the things that we've committed to doing is sharing our financials with our folks at certain points throughout the year. Now, you know, how does that show up? And it may show up differently for different organizations. You know, I'm not suggesting that all organizations need to put out their line-by-line P&L for all employees. That said, you know, the way we approached it is we show revenue, we show major expense categories, and we show what our profit is every year. And we also take time to educate what that means. You know, that the profit at the end of the year doesn't mean that somebody got a check for that money, that, you know, a significant amount of that money stays within the organization. But we really feel like that by sharing that information, people take a little bit more ownership. They understand the dynamics of the business better. And I think it just creates an environment of more trust, to be honest.
Would you say that FMS, Facilities Management Services, is a for-profit social enterprise? And what makes it that?
Yeah, I would definitely say we're a for-profit social enterprise. So the spectrum that I like to think about is maybe on the left-hand side, you have organizations that maybe have a corporate giving program, to where maybe there's a department around charitable giving, philanthropic endeavors. And by the way, this spectrum in no way is putting a value statement on either side of it, but mm-hmm. you have that. And on the right-hand side, you have what you might call a for-profit social enterprise. And that is an organization, I like to talk about it in terms of, whereas if you took out that social or environmental mission, the business would collapse because it's so inherently, it's so baked into the DNA of the organization. It's such an inherent part of it that the organization couldn't exist without that component. So for me, that's what a for-profit social enterprise is. It has social or environmental intentions and doings that are an integral part of the success of the organization.
Your organization, Canopy, offers a certification program for businesses. And I wonder, how is the Canopy certified program different from a B Corp certification or filing as a public benefit corporation?
Canopy really occupies a space we feel like hasn't been filled, and that is taking Kentucky companies and allowing them to enter into this larger conversation around this national and global movement towards socially conscious, impact-driven businesses. And we feel like the language and the way things are being talked about on this national scale isn't really going to resonate with Kentucky small and mid-sized businesses. So we created a tool that's really as much of a guide with a curriculum to teach and help companies move through the process as it is something to verify and sort of certify that they're doing it. So I like to think of the Canopy Certified Program as both a teaching mechanism and a verification mechanism as companies become more intentional around incorporating social and environmental good into their company. And at the same time, we're looking at how they're operating internally, how they're treating people, how their culture is, how their leaders are acting, and how that's showing up in their governance and their rules and regulations. So that's what Canopy's doing.
Well, Scott, I think people in our listening area would be really interested in hearing how Canopy came to our attention here at Eastern Standard. A member of your staff is very well known in these parts as a fantastic musician. And, of course, I'm talking about Ben Salih.
Correct.
Will Ben be applying his songwriting and performance skills in some way?
I certainly hope so. We definitely are very grateful to have Ben on board. Yeah, as you know, in Ben's music career, he's very much about environmental activism. Mm-hmm. So this was an easy fit for him. And he's certainly been, invaluable when it comes to getting the message out and the word out, you know, not only with his musical skills, but with his ability to put on events and of course, draw people and get the message. There is a trust that he brings, and we're really happy to have him aboard.
Well, it was great to hear from him. And Scott, great to talk with you. Scott Collins, founder of Canopy, a nonprofit advocating for socially and environmentally responsible businesses in Kentucky. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you so much.
Try, try, try. Try to move a mountain with that shovel in your hand. Choose, choose, choose. How to choose when there ain't no right or wrong. It must be why we've invented faith. Sky, 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 can't see it all at once. Tell, 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 there's no telling what history will bring. That must be why we've learned to pray. Can't wait to hold your little hand, hold your hand, child, hold your hand. You know I can't wait to hold your little hand, hold your hand, child, hold your hand.
Who?
Who?
What?
What?
Where?
Where?
When?
When?
Why?
We're talking with Bobby Clark of Sustainable Business Ventures, a nonprofit encouraging entrepreneurship in rural Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Bobby.
Thanks for having me.
And so you have a new program to tell us about.
Absolutely. We've got a program called Who Owns the Ice House? This is about a book about an African-American in the mid-50s that got tired of picking cotton and started an ice house. He hired his 13-year-old nephew, and the life lessons that he taught his nephew are the core part of this book. It was Pulitzer Prize nominated. There's been colleges and high schools all over the country that have been using this book. And so whether you're interested in starting a business or just learning these lessons that help you in anything you do, we're going to be offering a training program, a free training program to help people understand. And we want to establish an entrepreneur mindset in these rural communities.
And is the program based on the lessons learned from this book?
Absolutely. Things like problems are actually opportunities in disguise. You've got to be persistent. When you run up against a wall, you can say, oh, I'm going to quit, Or you can look at it and say, I'm going to be persistent and find a way to move forward with what I want to accomplish. And that's the entrepreneurial spirit.
Okay, when does this get underway?
It gets started next week. We're going to be able to offer this program online, and that way that people can participate. It's going to be 5:30 to 7:30 over 5 weeks. But the beauty of this, it doesn't matter which session you start with, whether it's session 2, 3, or 4.
So you can jump in anytime.
You can jump in at any time, and you can go to our website, www.sbventures.org/icehouse. And on that page, gives you all the background. It gives you short videos, kind of give you an understanding what's there, and a registration link to join us. We would like to get juniors and seniors in high school. We would like to get folks that are in substance abuse recovery. We want those that have had challenges with the law to get involved, because we believe that the entrepreneurial mindset can help move our communities forward, especially in rural communities that have many challenges.
And why are you doing this? What do you see as the outcome?
Well, the beauty is that after they finish this 5-week program, part of the program is we introduce the Opportunity Discovery Canvas. The first thing you do is, if you want to start a business, is what's the problem? Next, you got to identify the solution. Then you got to come up with how you can connect with your customers. So we walk all the participants through this process. And there's some great groups like SOAR, Business Innovation Champions, the Mountain Association of Community Economic Development. There's Kentucky Highlands in London, Southeast Kentucky Economic Development, and SBDCs. There's a lot of people helping. So once you finish this program, we're going to interact with you and get you introduced to the people and the resources you need to take this to the next level. So it's not just about learning. We want to empower people to start their own business and help their communities.
Bobby Clark of Sustainable Business Ventures. Thanks a lot, Bobby.
Thank you for having me.
And Berea College is holding its 46th annual Celebration of Traditional Music on October 10th through the 13th. Concerts, workshops, dancing, a fiddle contest, a gospel sing, open mic, and more. If you're interested and want to know more about this, you'll find the link on the facts and information page on our site, esweku.com. Coming up on next week's edition of Eastern Standard, what tops the list of worries for HR managers these days?
The shortage of employees that employers and businesses across the state of Kentucky are experiencing.
Katie Adams of the Kentucky Society of Human Resources Management says this talent shortage is across the spectrum.
Really, across all industries, from healthcare to construction to even administrative roles.
And what should you think if a hiring manager tells you you're overqualified for the job?
It depends when in the process you're told you're overqualified.
We hear from Beth Poland, an associate professor of management here at EKU. And what's the best way to put yourself out there on the job market? Maggie Abney, executive in residence for banking at EKU, says social media is fine.
But don't forget about the value of face-to-face contact and the handshake and the bonding experience that can occur at a networking event.
It's all about the networking.
Take it from one who lives it, Janice Way, leader of Leadership Kentucky.
True leaders are the ones who inspire you to be more, think more, dream more, make a positive difference.
Work life and leadership, next week on Eastern Standard. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We're ESWEKU on Instagram. Follow us and stay updated on what's in our content pipeline. And you can shoot us an email at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.